One of the easy parts about preaching the Old Testament is preaching about Jesus. That's really the easiest part because he's everywhere. You don't have to look hard to find Jesus in the text of the Old Testament. He said he's on every page. In fact, you may remember this. We looked at this verse a number of times. This is Jesus. He said, "Then he said to them, 'These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled.' Then he opened their minds to understand the scriptures and said to them, 'Thus it is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sin should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things.'" Now, when Jesus says, "Thus it is written," he's saying when the Old Testament prophets and the psalmists and the historians were writing, what they were really writing about is that Jesus was going to come, he was going to die, he was going to be buried, he would be then resurrected. He's saying all of the Old Testament is about that. So the easy part, the really, really easy part about preaching the Old Testament is preaching Jesus. Because he's there on every single page. But there's a hard part, and this is a really, really hard part. The hard part when it comes to preaching the Old Testament is preaching the Old Testament in its actual context. Because the temptation is to get to Jesus, and then you miss what it's actually saying in the words. Now, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about David and God's covenant with David. Now, David really did have a son named Solomon. Solomon really did become king after David, and Solomon really did inherit the promises to David. That's true. I have to tell you, that's the context. That really did happen. That is historical fact. But we also learned that God's covenant with David pointed to a greater fulfillment, someone beyond Solomon. Jesus would come, be that promised king. You see, Jesus fulfilled the covenant to David in a way that David couldn't have foreseen. Now, it's true, David prophesied about the resurrection in a number of his psalms, but there was no way for David to truly comprehend what it meant for God to give him this covenant. He couldn't tell that, okay, my son Solomon is going to become king, but then 1,000 years from now, I'm going to have another descendant who is going to fulfill my covenant in a greater way than I could ever imagine. And so the hard part of preaching the Old Testament is knowing when to talk about the Solomons in the text and when to talk about Jesus, because they're both there. You see, if I don't preach the context, which is the Solomons, immediate sort of fulfillment of the words of the text, if I don't preach about the Solomons, then I'm not telling you what the text says. But if I don't preach about Jesus, I'm not telling you what the text means. And so the difficulty is to know when, how much time do you spend talking about the Solomons in the text, and how much time do you spend talking about Jesus, because he's there in the text. So know this. It's about Jesus. It's always about... a preacher once said, he said, it's all about Jesus. It's always about Jesus. It's only about Jesus. And so let me just be open this morning. Our sermon is about Jesus. If next week, guess what our sermon's about? Jesus. If I'm preaching 30 years from now, guess what that message is about? Jesus. Makes it really easy to plan out a preaching schedule. The next, 500 Sundays, I'm preaching about Jesus. And when I'm done there, I'll just start it all over and go through the whole thing all over again. So just understand that the sermon this morning is about Jesus. It's about Jesus. But in order to get to Jesus, we have to first understand what the context is. What is the text saying? And then we'll look at what the text means. So let me give you a quick overview of where we've been so far in our sermon series, From Garden to Garden, the story of the Bible. God created Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve rebelled against God, and so God kicked them out of the garden. Death passed on to men, and relationships shattered, and death and disease and all kinds of bad things came to earth. A little while later, God promised to send one to rescue them from all that sin and death. Years go by, and God calls a man named Abraham. Abraham is going to be a special representative of God on earth, Abraham and his descendants. He gave him some great promises that he would multiply them, that he would bless the world through through his descendants, and so God did that. As these descendants grew in number, we see they end up in a place called Egypt. Then they ended up being enslaved in Egypt, but God had a plan, and so he raised up some events to happen, and God rescued them out of Egypt to make them his special people. They end up in the very land that God promised to give to Abraham. Now, while shortly after they get there, shortly after they leave Egypt, they're at Mount Sinai, and God makes them some promises. But the promises are conditional. If you will obey me, if you will keep my covenant, then I'm going to give you some special privileges. Now, the privileges are blessings, material prosperity. Their babies wouldn't die young. They'd live long lives. They'd have, you know, lots of influence in the world. They would be God's special people in a very powerful way if they obeyed him. No obedience, no blessings. If they failed to keep the covenant, all bets were off. Well, as these people continued to grow, God put them in the land that he promised to give to Abraham. Now, sometime later, after they were in the land, they asked for a king. Saul became king, and later David became king. When David became king, God made another covenant with David to place one of his descendants on his throne forever. It would be an eternal, everlasting kingdom. In David's son Solomon's day, God's promises to Abraham were fulfilled. The people of Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore, 1 Kings tells us. They were blessed with prosperity that was just unheard of. Either then or now, there's no nation on earth that has been that wealthy. There's no nation on earth where you can go where silver has no value. There's that much gold in that kingdom. Solomon's wisdom was a blessing to the whole world. So the promise that Abraham's descendants would bless the whole world, it was coming true. Solomon was blessing the whole world. And it wasn't just Israel that was blessed with prosperity because of their trade dealing with other nations. Other nations became wealthy. That's how they're able to send so much tribute to Solomon. I mean, it was an amazing kingdom. The world has never seen its like before or since. However, as we saw a couple weeks ago, Solomon sinned, and he sinned a lot. Because he sinned a lot, God made another promise to him that he was going to take away the kingdom, all that he had done so far, from his son. And so Solomon died, Rehoboam became king. And shortly after, the 10 northern tribes broke away and said, we don't want you anymore. And they appointed a man named Jeroboam to be their king. And things were rough for a while. Egypt came to the southern kingdom of Judah and roughed them up for a bit, stole most of the treasure, actually all the treasure, out of the king's palace, out of the temple. And so what had been a very wealthy kingdom very quickly, overnight, became a very poor kingdom. So time goes on. There were wars. There were victories. There were some defeats. Good things happened. Some bad things happened. But Israel and Judah, Abraham's descendants, were still as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They were still in their land that God promised to give to them. Now, both nations, south and north, experienced some prosperity. They experienced periods of greater power or lesser power. Things were just kind of going along. Except they didn't remember the God who rescued them out of Egypt. They forgot that it was Yahweh, God of Israel, who did the rescuing. So God sends them prophets. Prophet after prophet came to both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, warned them, look, you got to stop doing this. You got to worship the God who rescued you. Stop worshiping these false gods. They can do nothing for you. Only God can bless you with the covenant blessings. But they wouldn't listen. Now God warned them repeatedly about the consequences of their sins. Keep doing this, I'm going to remove you from the land. And still, they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't turn away from worshiping false idols. So this brings us to 2 Kings chapter 17. So if you have your Bibles, turn there with me. If you have one of these black Bibles the church provides, it's page 323. If you'd like one, stick up your hand. We'll probably get someone who can bring some. Anyone over here? Anyone? Got a couple over here? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and read. We're going to start reading in verse 6. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria, and he carried the Israelites away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and on the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. And this occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and had feared other gods, and walked in the customs of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel, and in the customs that the kings of Israel had practiced. Down to verse 18. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. None was left but the tribe of Judah only. It's a very simple statement, isn't it? Yahweh, God of Israel, was angry with Israel, and so he removed them from the land. That's it. Not a lot of fluff there. Not a lot of flowery language. It's a very simple and direct statement. After a little over 200 years of their constant rebellion against him, God punished the nation of Israel. In the year 722 BC, the northern nation of Israel ceased to exist. It was gone. But it's not like it happened all of a sudden. It's not like on Tuesday there was Israel, on Wednesday it wasn't. It had been going on for a period of decades. God had raised up Assyria, and one by one over the years, Syria was capturing more and more cities of Israel. As the prophets were warning them, look, if you keep worshiping false gods, this is going to accelerate. And that's exactly what it did. It accelerated to the point where the king of Assyria shows up in Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom, and he captured them, and he took them all out of the land God promised to Abraham, and he took them to another place to live. You know, it's remarkable to me how unemotional this text is. It's just a statement of fact. Israel sinned, God got really angry, God took them out of the land. He removed them. Now think of it. These are Abraham's descendants. They belong in the land. This is the land God promised to give to them. They were supposed to show the world just how great Yahweh, God of Israel, really is. They were his people. But no matter what, they weren't going to act like it. They refused to act like his people, despite all he had done for them. And because of their sin, the text simply says God removed them from the land. That's kind of extreme, isn't it? I mean, yeah, they've done some bad things, but to take them out and undo all the promises that he had fulfilled under Solomon, it was gone. 200 years later, it's gone. To take them away so completely, so finally, gives us a sense of just how bad their sin was. Look at verses 21 through 23 there in chapter 17. When he, God, had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. The people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. Now, these few verses are a complete history of the northern nation of Israel. Very brief. Now, there's other details you could put in. This king reigned this time to this time, and this king did this and fought this war. But the fact is, that is the entire history of the nation of Israel. Jeroboam became king. He did really bad stuff. Israel copied the really bad stuff until God got so mad, he removed them from the land. It's a simple. All you really need to know is it happened in the year 722 BC. You know, the entire nation. I mean, how can you ever sum up in a nation's entire history? You could do it in one sentence. They picked a king who did bad stuff. They copied his bad stuff until God got mad enough to remove him from the land in 722 BC. One sentence. That's the history of Israel. Now, what is it that Jeroboam did that was so bad? What is it? I mean, to understand, we have to first go back and understand what are the circumstances under which he became king. Now, we know the story. Rehoboam was stupid, and Solomon had sinned, and so God had promised he'd take it away. But because of Rehoboam's foolishness, they rejected him. But what is the real reason Jeroboam became king? Turn back to 1 Kings 11 with me. 1 Kings chapter 11. Verse 25. Actually, no, we're not there yet. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me just summarize. God had promised to Solomon that he would take away the kingdom from Solomon's son. His son was Rehoboam. Now, he also made a promise to Jeroboam in the same chapter. He promised Jeroboam that he would make him king. He would give 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel to Jeroboam. You've got to remember, this at the time is the most prosperous nation on earth. Along with becoming ruler of 10 of the tribes, he's also going to assume all of their wealth. Now, the wealth in Jerusalem would stay, but most of that wealth came from the other tribes, the tribes that God was going to give him. It's a tremendous offer that God gives him. So he promises to give him the kingdom and promises, this is crazy, he promises to make Jeroboam's kingdom last as long as David's kingdom. How long did David's kingdom, how long is that supposed to last? Forever. God is telling Jeroboam, he says, look, if you will follow me, if you will obey me and do everything I tell you to do, your kingdom will last as long as David's. The difference, though, with David's promise is Jeroboam's promise is conditional. God was going to fulfill the promise to David, regardless of what David did. With Jeroboam, though, his blessings of the promise were dependent on his behavior. Jeroboam must do what is right. Imagine a guy comes to you, and he promises to give you $1 million a day, every day for the rest of your life. Got one condition. The one condition is you have to thank him when he gives it to you. So to show you that he's telling the truth, he gives you $10 million to sort of get you started. And he gives you that day's $1 million. So at the very beginning of the promise, he says, here's $11 million. Now, if he shows up at your door the next day, what are you going to do? Really? You're going to say, thank you. That's all you have to do to keep getting this. That's what's happening here. God says, I'm going to give you an everlasting kingdom. All you have to do is obey me. To show you that I'm going to do it, here are the 10 tribes. When Jeroboam became king, there was no civil war. God prevented that. Rehoboam gathered the army of 180,000 and wanted to go up and fight. God said, no, you can't do that. So there's no battle going on. He just simply gives him. I mean, he shows up. They're like, hey, come from Egypt. All right, we don't like this guy. We want you to be king. Oh, okay. I mean, there's no job interview. There's no lengthy process. There's no background checks. There's no resume he has to send in. There's no committee he has to meet with. They just said, we want you to be king. God gives it to him. He just dumps this incredible blessing on him. All he has to do to keep it is obey the voice of Yahweh, God of Israel. Now, chapter 12, verse 25. How does he respond to this promise? Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim. Ephraim is the northern kingdom, another name for it, and lived there. And he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and return to Jeroboam, king of Judah. So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Why was Jeroboam king? He was king because God said he would be king. God orchestrated the events so he would become king with very little effort. All he had to do was show up. That's why he became king. How can Jeroboam remain king? By being faithful to God, the very God who made him king in the first place. Instead, Jeroboam fears losing his kingdom because the people may return to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, the southern kingdom, see this magnificent temple that Solomon had built, see the wealth that was still present in Jerusalem. He's like, well, if they see that, they'll want Rehoboam as king. Who made him king? God made him king. Who's going to keep him king? God is going to keep him king. What does he do? He makes two golden calves. Baby cows made out of gold. And then he says, Israel, these baby cows made out of gold are the gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt. The baby cows made out of gold that I just made are the very gods who rescued you over 500 years ago. Doesn't make any sense. Yahweh, God of Israel, made him king. And he's turning to some statues, some little figurines, some knickknacks made out of gold. See, it doesn't stop there either. The text goes on to describe, he goes on, he establishes his own priesthood. God said the Levites were the priests. He makes his own priesthood. He establishes some feasts throughout the year. All of it is to mimic the real religion that God had given Moses on Mount Sinai. All of the rules, the laws, those sorts of things, he replaced them with his own religion. Not worshiping Yahweh, God of Israel, worshiping these baby cows made out of gold. You know, false worship can often look a lot like true worship. It's easy to replace true worship with false worship. It's easy to say all the right things and not mean it. It's easy to say all the right things and have the wrong motivation for it. False worship often looks like true worship. You see, all Jeroboam did in this case was he replaced Yahweh with some baby cows made out of gold. See, it's easy for people to make substitutes for the real God because false gods don't make many demands on you. You see, God said, no, once a year you're going to go travel to Jerusalem and you're going to worship me there. Well, these false gods didn't require that. You can stay right here in your own country. You don't have to travel over to Judah. You can stay right here in Israel. They didn't make a lot of demands on them. They could be manipulated and controlled. False gods can do what you tell them to do. The one true God doesn't have to. Turn back to chapter 17. Jeroboam thinks that these gods, these baby cows made out of gold, would keep the people from returning to Rehoboam. Even though it was God who caused them to turn to him, it was God who promised that they would stay his subjects, he still thought that these baby cows made out of gold would save him. Verse 22 in chapter 17. The people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them. These sins, this false worship, these worshiping of baby cows and all the other gods of the land, all the other things that accompanies that. See, what's happening is the nation of Israel is committing national suicide. They're killing themselves. God says, if you want to live, here's how you live. Like, we're going to reject that. We're going to do our own thing. God says, that leads to death. You're going to die if you do those things. That's okay. We got to figure it out. Because we have baby cows made out of gold. You see, they rejected Rehoboam as king, but they also rejected Yahweh, God of Israel, as king. They worshipped and served false gods. See, they thought that rejecting the true God was the way that they would get what they wanted, but in reality, worshipping the true God was the only way to get what they truly wanted. God is the only way to get the covenant blessings. You see the real problem here? The real problem is the covenant. The problem lies in the covenant itself because the covenant God gave them was incapable of making Israel into a holy nation. About 700 years before God destroys Israel as a nation, God made Israel a nation. That was about how long it had been since he brought them out of Egypt. He made them a nation. Look at this from Exodus 19. I got to get over here. On the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, remember, this is about 6 weeks. On that day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain, while Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the house of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak to the people of Israel." Now this happens while they're encamped on Mount Sinai. Moses is up the mountain, God comes down and talks to him, he gets the Ten Commandments, God gives him the covenant, making them his people. Now look at what he's promising. If you will indeed obey my voice, three things will happen. First, you will be my treasured possession. If you obey my voice, you will be my treasured possession. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you'll be a kingdom of priests. If you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, you will be a holy nation. Problem. Israel did not obey his voice and did not keep his covenant. So what does that mean? It means they're not a treasured possession. It means they're not a kingdom of priests. It means they're not a holy nation. In fact, hundreds of years after disobeying his voice and hundreds of years of breaking his covenant, they cease to be a nation at all, let alone a holy nation. See, the covenant was not able to make Israel holy. The covenant did not have the power within it to bring about the promises. It was dependent upon Israel. That's the problem. The covenant on Mount Sinai failed to make the nation of Israel holy because it was based on the behavior of Israel to begin with. If you do this, then I will do this. The covenant did not make them the people God wanted them to be. It was based on their behavior, their ability to keep it. Just like the covenant with Jeroboam, if you will obey me, do everything I tell you to do, I'll make your kingdom eternal. I'll make it an everlasting kingdom. Your sons and their sons will continue to remain on this throne if you will obey me. The problem with any covenant that is based on us is it's doomed to fail. It's doomed to fail. There's no way we can keep it. It's beyond our ability. And so because it was based on Israel, it failed. The covenant failed miserably. It didn't make Israel holy. It only revealed how unholy they were. Israel needed God to fulfill the covenant for them because they were never going to make it on their own. Now, the Apostle Paul says something interesting in his letter to the Galatians. He said that the law of Moses, that is the covenant, the law is the covenant with Israel. The law of Israel, or of Moses, was intended to point them to Jesus. All of these rules that they couldn't keep, all of these requirements that they could never meet, the purpose of those requirements wasn't to make them holy because it couldn't do that. It didn't have the power to do it. It was to point them to Jesus. It was to reveal to them they needed someone else to do it for them. See, God knew this covenant was flawed. In fact, Hebrews 8, we'll look at that next week. Hebrews 8 tells us it was flawed. There was something wrong with the covenant. It couldn't do what it was supposed to do. But God knew that. He knew that because he had another purpose. You see, making Israel holy wasn't the purpose of the law. The purpose was to point them to Jesus. That is the true and final purpose of the law. Now, before God sent them into exile, he sent to them a number of prophets. One of the prophets was a man named Hosea. He wrote the book of Hosea. So in Hosea's letter, God is recording all of his arguments against... It's like a prosecution is going on. God is standing before the jury himself, and he's laying out all of the things they've done wrong. You did this, you didn't do this, I warned you, you did this, and you did that. And so God is prosecuting them for their crimes. While doing that, though, he points out that he loves them. He reminds them of their sins, and he also reminds them of his love for them. Isn't that amazing? God is explaining all the reasons why he's about to destroy them as a nation. He says, by the way, I love you. Isn't that amazing? While God is in the midst of punishing them, he points out, look, I've shown you nothing but love for all these centuries. That's incredible. Now, he reminds them of a historical fact in Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. It says, when Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. Now, when Israel was a tiny little nation, it was, you know, the 12 tribes, you know, the Jacob and his 12 sons. They go there with they have some families, about 70 people in all. They go down to Egypt to get grain and to escape from the famine that was consuming that area of the world. Just a few people. While there, though, they become this great nation. They're enslaved, and then God literally calls them out of Egypt. Come out of Egypt. I want you to come to me, meet me at Mount Sinai. While at Mount Sinai, you will become my adopted son. I will make you my nation. I will make you my treasured possession. I will make you a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. So this happened. Out of Egypt, God really did call his son. There is a real sense, and this is a historical fact. When Hosea writes it, he doesn't seem to be making any sort of prophetic statement. This happened. 700-ish or 500-ish years before then, this happened. Out of Egypt, I called my son. Now Matthew, interestingly, Matthew does something extraordinary with this statement. Look at Matthew chapter 2. He writes, when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I have called my son. Matthew says that God orchestrated the events in the Middle East there, in the land of Israel, so that Joseph would take his wife Mary and her son Jesus and take him to Egypt to escape from Herod trying to kill all the young children. Why? Why did that happen? Matthew is saying that Jesus is the true Israel. This is cool. Jesus is the true Israel. Now, there was a real Israel. They were the ethnic descendants of Abraham. Jesus was one of them. He was part of the people of Israel. In them, in the ethnic people of Israel, God fulfills his promise to Abraham, his covenant with Abraham. But in Jesus, the true Israel of God, God fulfills his promise in a greater way, a way that Abraham himself couldn't have understood. He fulfills his promise in a way that none of the prophets could truly figure out. In fact, we know that in the New Testament, that the prophets, the angels themselves, looked in what the prophets wrote, tried to figure out what does all this stuff mean. Jesus fulfills the promise to Israel in a way that could not have been picked up. You could have read the Old Testament a billion times before he actually came and not truly understood what it was that he was coming to do. It's amazing. You see, this Israel would obey God fully. This Israel would be a holy people. This Israel would be a light to the world. This Israel would be all that God requires men and women to be. He would be all that in a way that no one else ever could possibly be. See, when Jesus came, we read in the New Testament that he was born under the law. That means he had to fulfill all the requirements that every other Israelite had to fulfill. There were 613 laws. Jesus had to obey them. He was born under that. He was of the nation of Israel. That law was his law. He had to do everything his father told him to do. But unlike every other Israelite, he actually did. He actually obeyed all those laws. He didn't break any of them. He was the true Israel. You know, it's interesting, when you read the first several chapters of Matthew, you see Jesus really retracing the steps of Israel. Out of Egypt, God calls his son. And where do they end up? They end up in the wilderness. Now, if you read the book of Exodus, you'll find out that they sin almost literally from the very beginning. They start grumbling against God. They're complaining it was better back then before we saw this miraculous stuff. It'd be better. We had food to eat. I mean, at one point, God got so mad, he's like, I'm going to kill him right here, Moses. And Moses is like, no, people will mock you. And it's like, okay, I won't do it. Israel sins in the wilderness. Right after God, or several years after God calls Jesus out of Egypt, what does Jesus do? He ends up in a wilderness being led by the Holy Spirit. And what happens? He's tempted by Satan. But what did this Israel do? He refused to sin. He obeyed his father. He did what Israel was supposed to do in their wilderness. But this Israel was the true Israel. And he obeyed. See, God knew Israel would fail. He knew it. But he had another plan. And that plan was to send one who would represent them. He would be the people that he intended ethnic Israel to do. And he would do what they never would do. You know, God had mercy on the ethnic nation of Israel for a very long time. There were periods of punishment that he would dole out. But he always showed mercy to them. On the true Israel, though, God wouldn't show mercy. There was no mercy for Jesus. Jesus prayed in the garden, God, if there's any other way, let's do that. God said, no mercy for you. I'm going to pour out all my wrath on you. See, on the true Israel, all of God's wrath would be poured. On the true Israel, all his anger and his hatred for sin would be exhausted. On this Israel, there is no mercy. God unleashes all of his fury and righteous anger for sin. And he does it one time for all time. See, when we think about what Jesus did for us, we have to remember that what happened on the cross was the culmination of what Jesus did for us. There's more than that. He lived 33 years prior to that. In all of those 33 years, each one of them was lived for us. See, it's not just that Jesus endured the penalty for us breaking God's law. Jesus obeyed for us. This is the good news of the gospel. Jesus absolutely had to bear the penalty for our sin. He had to. God cannot not punish sin. Sin must be punished. But Jesus also obeyed for us. God's wrath for our sin was satisfied by his death, but God is now also pleased with us because of his life. You know, in Jesus' day, there was a group of people called the Pharisees, and they were widely regarded as the best people. I mean, they were very exact. They obeyed God's law to the letter. If the law said give 10%, they calculated it out to a whole bunch of decimals. They didn't want to give one penny more, and they didn't want to give one penny less. I mean, they were very precise in obeying God. Listen to what Jesus said about them. He said, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." Notice what he doesn't say. He didn't say, "Unless your sins are paid for by me." Now, that's true. We have a tremendous amount of evidence in Scripture that Jesus had to bear the penalty for sin. But here he says, your righteousness, you must be good enough to enter the kingdom of heaven. See, Jesus' death didn't take care of that part of it. So what does? See, God requires righteousness. The nation of Israel shows us that we need Jesus to be our righteousness. We need God's true Israel to live for us and to die for us. God sees his righteous life, and he sees us in it. Not that we're the ones doing it, but God treats us as if we had lived Jesus' life. That's incredible. The righteousness of Jesus is applied to us. He's able to rise from the dead because of his obedience. God's wrath was satisfied. The reason he died no longer existed. He wasn't angry at us anymore. Because of his obedience, both in obeying God's law and in receiving the penalty for breaking God's law, we become the righteousness of God. He sees us as holy because Jesus is holy. He sees us as perfect. Why? Because Jesus is perfect. You know what that means? It means you're righteous in God's eyes. Laura, God says you're righteous in Jesus. Joel, God says you're righteous in Jesus. Dee Dee, you're righteous in Jesus. Bethany, you're righteous because of Jesus. He lived your life for you because he knew you couldn't do it. He knew you wouldn't do it. That's why I say all the time, Jesus lived the life we wouldn't live, and he died the death we couldn't die. Not one of us is willing to live the life God calls us to live. That's why we don't do it. There's nothing stopping us. Yeah, we have sin, but we choose that sin. Jesus didn't. Jesus chose the righteousness for us. Because of Jesus, we're declared righteous in God's sight. Because of his death, the penalty is removed. Because of the life and death of Jesus, we stand complete, whole, perfect, holy in God's sight. Because of Jesus, we are his treasured possession, Titus tells us. Because of Jesus, Revelation 1 tells us, we are that kingdom of priests. Because of Jesus, Peter tells us, we, the church, are that holy nation, that people for his own possession. Because of Jesus. See, this whole book is about Jesus. The nation of Israel shows us we need him. The rest of the New Testament shows us how it is that he comes to do that for us. He lived a life of perfect obedience. He died an absolutely perfect and complete death so that in him we would be the righteousness of God.